Session number 13660.
Mr. Saunders, real four.
Right. Unknown to it. I did not know that all this went on. The Templar insisted on having insisting on the appointment of a European financial advisor to sort things out. And I did sell a very Lady Templar was a rider, and I had a very pretty polo pony, which was had an ancestry as long as my arm, and the father won the derby, but it wouldn't play polo, and I sold it to Lady Templar for next to nothing, maybe $500 or $700 or something like that, as a hack. It just looked pretty, but it, you know, polo is rugby on horseback, and this chap didn't, this called Chrysanthemum, it didn't have the guts. However, and then Templar heard of this and said to her, send it back, and Lady Templar said no. And you know, there is a thing in government regulations that you're not allowed to deal with officers of vastly senior rank, for obvious reasons. I mean, a captain can sell a horse to a captain or a major at a pinch, but a lieutenant can't sell a horse to a general. And I was a middle-ranking police officer, maybe the equivalent of a half-colonel in the army. Of course, I am not supposed to trade with the wife of the High Commissioner of Southeast Asia, you see. However, and there's a file quite sick about this, like of everything else in government. But whenever there's an argument, they start a file on the thing, you see. And Lady Templar refused to, because it was a very nice little house, and of course, I didn't make a profit on this. I mean, probably a loss. However, so that's why he knew me, or of me. But I got my loan, and I paid most of His Highness's debts, even though there was a lot of jiggery pokery. I sort of found out that runners were sent out to say, I owe you so much, rather like in the Bible, you know, the steward, you know, who tells a man who owes money to whom his master owes money, say so much and so on. I didn't mind all that. I just wanted to clear things up and get it under my control, and I've done that. Actually, I did intend to stay with the police until I had it in writing that it was a secondment to the Pahang, to the state of Pahang, and because I didn't want to jeopardize my career or my pension. But one day, Sultan rang me up. He said, look, George, are you, after I was already selected by him, well, George, if you're not coming right now, and I mean this week or next week, I'm going to appoint somebody else because I want you on my world tour. Now, of course, when you are in your early 30s, you don't think about pension. And the world tour was a great attraction, you know, organizing a world tour for a ruler and you know, red carpet treatment around the world and so on. And so, unwisely, I left Singapore to go to Pahang. And then I found that, and that is where I've really come face to face with emergency, and I found out that there was a lot of killing and robbery and so on, and disturbance in certain areas in the jungle and what have you. So, and you must, you know, I don't know whether you know, Pahang consists of nine states, Malaya consists of nine states. Pahang is a third of the country. It's one of the nine, but much more territory. And there was much more of an area where things could go wrong, you know. And that is where my liaison with King's House, that is where Templar lived, started. I tried never ever to wear, if I had to see the Sultan on business in audience, I had to wear a suit and a tie. I tried to avoid that. And also there were one or two old men sitting on the floor listening in, and the whole village knew what I was talking about. So I preferred to discuss the day's business with him on the polo ground. I built a race course around the polo ground. He got on his horse, I got on mine, and we discussed the day's business or last week's something. And he was a very easy man to work for because he never changed his mind. If he says poli, that means yes, can do. He never came back next day. Or if he says tomorrow, this I don't want it, then he was not to be persuaded that it's on after all. So he's an easy man to work for. If I got a call from King's House that there is a bit of nonsense in Ulu Tembiling, let us say that this is sort of a tiny little village in the middle of nowhere, kampong. I said, all right, I'll obtain His Highness's command. Told him, look, there's some nonsense with the bandits, you know, sort of stealing and blackmailing people and so on. And he said, yes, okay, we can do that. And he would, that was his strength, you see, he would cancel a race meeting in Singapore or going to Penang or whatever, you know, for some kind of, we had houses everywhere. We had houses in Singapore and Penang and Kuala Lumpur, of course. And he simply considered himself during the emergency as the leader of the country, and he considered the last Malay more important than the most senior European. And that was his strength, and that is what Templar respected. And so I would then go back to my office after breakfast and say, okay, I have obtained His Highness's command, and he says, go ahead and so on, will you make the plans, and will you do the usual? And some ladies, he laughed his head and said, yes, of course. The usual was this. You see, Malay ladies do not, I mean, in Pahang, in Johor perhaps, but in Malay, in Pahang, the daughters and wives do not dance. The men dance and whores dance, dancing girls, they call them, they're just whores. So then some ADC said to me, have you any particulars? And I said, well, just send a fleet of my Texas guard to Bukit Bintang, this is a local dance hall, and we round up, so 15, 20 birds. And then these ladies came in Mercedes taxis over the mountains and back to Pekan, you see, that took 2 or 3 days, you see, arrange all that. That was the arrangements, you see. And then the court being the ruler, his royal brothers, a few officials, hangers on, and so on, and Georgie went to visit that area. And by Rolls Royce, by boat, by bicycle, on foot, but we got there. You know, these things happen often, not just once or twice a year, but sort of. Not once or twice a month, but certainly, let us say, in 2 months, maybe 3 times, you see. I mean, more than once a month, you know, during the height of the emergency. It was abating, but it was still there. It was about a year after Ernie Gurney was killed. We went to that village, and then the Sultan said, you see all these tall boys and girls, you see, these are all my children, and the children of my royal brothers. He obviously believed in the Jux Prima Nocte. And then he took command of the headman's house, which had a decent veranda and so on, rather like this. But all the houses were on stilts, you see. And he held court. Anyone who had anything to say came to him. The district officer was in attendance, and of course he hated these royal shows. He said, why should they come to the Sultan when they could have anything they wanted? The district officer was English, of course. And because many of the villages, they had this love for their ruler, and they preferred to talk to him. And he sat there like a judge, and they came grovelling, you know, and told him this and that and the other, you know. And he sort of gave very quick judgments based on common sense. Right. And then there was dancing, rongi, at night, until 2, 3, 4, 5 in the morning, with these girls, you see. The whole court and the local men cavorting up and down. Back. You know the Malay dancing, you don't touch each other. You know that, don't you?
Yes.
It's this thing, rongi. There's a band, our own band, which we took with us, you see. Right. That went on 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. Then the elders came very humbly and said, oh, Tuanku, you know, Tunku is Prince, Tuanku is the ruler. Tuanku, we're greatly honored by your visit. But we hardly deserve this humble community. But all the chickens are dead. The goats are diminishing. There's hardly a cow alive. Because a court descending on the little village like the locust, you see. Much longer may we have the honor to be blessed by your visit, you say. And they said, look, it's come to my ears. But he would wait 2 or 3 days before he opened his mouth. Look, it's come to my ears that the bandits were never referred to as communist or Chinese. They were called wicked men, Orang Jahat. It's come to my ears that you supported these wicked men. You gave them money. You gave them grain. Oh, they blackmailed us and this and this. Look, never mind. I will leave tomorrow. But if I hear that you give 1 grain of rice or 1 ringgit, $1 to these wicked men, I shall stay here until you're bled white. Do you mean to say you can afford to feed these communists, this Orang Jahat, is the Malay name, and not support your own raja? That's it. Then again, dancing into the night, and we left the next day. But that village never ever supported another bandit, ever.
But would not the guerrillas terrorize them? If
No. They were more frightened of their raja than of the bandits, you see. And some time after I was there for about 6 months or a year later, somebody complained to the Templar about... You see, Pahang was big. Pahang was a third of the country. You see, it's only one of 9 states, but it's a very big area. The Templar is supposed to have said to this chap, whoever, some quite senior general, look, he said, if all the rajas would behave like Pahang, there'd be no bandits. And as long as the Raja of Pahang and George Saunders saves me 2 battalions, they can have all the bloody horse and polo ponies they like.
How did you leave this job with Pahang?
It left me after independence.
So you lost the job as soon as they became independent?
Not as soon, but it's more and more difficult. Eventually, all the Europeans dropped out. I was the last European member of EXCO and LEGCO, Executive and Legislative Council of State. I was ex officio member, being his right-hand man. The Sultan sat at one end of the table, I sat at the other. They were the elected and they were the appointed councillors. And it was always Saunders must go. It's rather like Hannibal ante Portas, you know. I had to live my life most obliquely. If I knew of a small village which I felt really ought to have a school, I would say, oh, this is a very unimportant village. I don't think it needs a school for a long time. Some socialist councillor would jump up and say, on the contrary, it's a very important village. It is a thriving community, and it must have a school. So I got my school. And similarly with roads and with whatever. You know, I had to live my life very obliquely, and it was gradually untenable. It's rather sad. And I lost my job, then it came to an end, terminally, you know, simply by end of contract, you know. They didn't do anything illegally. But I thought I'm going to be there forever and ever and ever until I retire, you know. And I must say that after about 6 months, I got a letter inviting me to come back as secretary to the Sultanate, which really means... Everything went. See, we Europeans make a mistake. If things aren't done our way, it doesn't work. It's nonsense. It also works. Not like we do.
But in a different way.
Different way. But they asked me to come back as secretary of the Sultanate, because the Sultan liked me personally, right? And
so why didn't you go?
Well, but I mean, I had that ministerial rank. I was a member of EXCO and LEGCO, and to come back as a clerk. I wish I had, because after that I had no job and no income. I applied for, well, have you ever applied for jobs and been on the short list and then turned down? And I have curriculum vitae, best suit, tie, yes sir, no sir, and either you had the wrong qualification or you were too senior for this or for that. I had very lean years, you know. And why didn't I go? Well, then I went into advertising, I believe I told you.
Yes,
right. Yes. Right, so but the fact is that I had the greatest regard for him. He was an easy man to work for. He never changed his mind when we were on a world tour and we had a house in London. First we lived at the Dorchester. I found it far too expensive, you see. it was wonderful, this world tour. You see, I didn't, long before we went, I wrote to the sort of, I didn't know such an animal existed or not. I wrote to the secretary in All American Polo Association, and I got a letter back from James Hannaford Cushingwood the third or something, you know, the way he's and inviting us but we had this on this world tour. The Sultan went and his one wife, and not the Sultan, is the number one wife, you see. But he was a wonderful man to work for in many ways, but in others not, you see. I mean, there was a prime minister who hated me. He really could not stand me. And the local prime minister of Pahang. But we dropped our rank a little bit. He went as private secretary, I went as ADC on the world tour. He was a socialist. He wanted the Sultan to see, I'll just knock him down. He wanted the Sultan to see trade union and industries and factories and things. I wanted him to go to the cocktail parties and meet film stars and polo tournaments and things, you know. We played polo around the world, you see. And it was great fun. But and that I really mean, if all rulers in Malaya at that time, now it's called Malaysia, had behaved like the Sultan of Pahang, I think the communists would have been finished much earlier. They hobnob with Europeans and lived in their palaces and golf courses. None of them ever went to this comfort of actually going into the jungle and that was Pahang's way of doing it. But the villagers in the jungle were more frightened of him in the end than the communists.
But these were presumably Malay villagers rather than Chinese villagers.
Of course, there are no Chinese in the jungle. There are only Chinese in the villages on the east or west coast, or in places like Kemalaw, you know. But in the kampongs in the interior are all Malay, you see.
But presumably they weren't the backbone of the emergency anyway.
Yeah, but I mean the communists tried to the Chinese communists tried to infiltrate these things, but they were not resident in the jungle. They were terrorists from after all, in I think in Northern Ireland, I mean the terrorists aren't villagers. I mean they come from somewhere else, don't they?